This is Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and your questions, all about NPB. And now your hosts, Johnny Gibson and Jin Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of August 26th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Saturday evening in the same time zone, but not in the same zip code, is my buddy Jim Allen. What's up, dude?
I'm okay. I'm glad to have you back in the area, back in the same, in the same Japan Standard Time.
Glad to be home.
Otsukare-sama. Yeah. Good luck with the jet lag.
Yeah, the jet lag is the problem. But more than that, the airline was the problem getting off on this trip. That it was like the technical difficulties we had in recent weeks. we got to Los Angeles and we were heading to Alabama. So we got to Los Angeles and the flight had been delayed from Japan. So we missed our connection to Atlanta that would have put us on a connection to Alabama. But the guy at the desk didn't tell us that when we would land in Atlanta that we wouldn't have any way to get to Alabama that night, and that we would have to stay over and take the first flight out the next morning. He just kind of just said, here's your tickets, bye. And so we got to Atlanta and we missed the connection there. We had to sleep on the floor at the airport basically traveling 24 hours. It was awful. So
actually, I've done that twice.
I've done it, just not with my family.
That's true. I've never done it with kids. I've done it with when I was a teenager with a group of 30 teenagers sleeping on the floor of Barcelona Airport. But
so trust me when I tell you, I'm glad to be home in Japan where the service is king.
Indeed.
Customer service is what it's all about. That would never happen in Japan. They would always have an agent there. You know, we had to call on the telephone. It was awful. Anyway, I don't even remember. This is more than a week ago. So let bygones be gone by.
Good advice. We're not going back. We're moving forward.
All right. On this week's show, we've got former Yakult pitcher and current Swallow scout Tony Barnett here to talk about his new book. We've got pennant race talk, rocking with Roki, and we're going to talk home run rates and then handle some high heat if we have time. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
So I received an email recently from Tony Barnett, and he asked if we were still doing the podcast. So whoever our director of promotions is, he needs to be fired, because if Tony Barnett doesn't know that we're still putting out a podcast, we're in trouble. The dude has been on here, you know, numerous times throughout the years. And so I'm thinking, whoever this promotion guy is, marketing, fire the guy. And it's not you.
Well, it couldn't be me because I've never done any work. So I couldn't be the guy working on marketing.
All right. Well, get marketing on the phone.
Sorry, I don't work.
So anyway, Tony asked me if we're still putting out the podcast, and I said, yeah. And then he explained that he had a book coming out. In fact, we talked about the book. You mentioned it, and I know you tweeted something out earlier this year. And so he wanted to come on and discuss it. And I said, heck yeah, you know, you donated a lot of hours of your time to us through the years. And you, my friend, are asking to come on to the show. You're invited. I didn't say talk as long as you like, but I did say we will gladly talk about your book. So please, my friend, you are invited to come on, and we'll do it as soon as we can. And, you know, we usually get scouts or former players in the off season during normal years that are not Corona. But for Tony, we were making a happy exception. And his book is called A Baseball Gaijin, Chasing a Dream to Japan and Back. Aaron Fishman basically wrote the book, and Tony is the subject of it. And I asked Tony one question about the book, and, you know, throughout my years talking to Tony and asking him questions, he has always been really good, but I only needed to ask him one question. It was the way I framed it, which you'll hear. And he pretty much covered all the other questions I had by giving us the backstory. So let's take a listen to Tony Barnett.
All right, joining us is former Yakult Swallows pitcher and MLB pitcher. And what? He's a current scout with the Swallows and now author, quasi author. You're famous in all in many countries. And it's good to have you back on the show, Tony Barnett.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
Thanks so much. And I want to tell everyone how this came about because you have published a book and it is called A Baseball Gaijin, Chasing a Dream to Japan and Back. And it was released this summer, I believe. It hit the shelves and whatever else is out there. I imagine that it's on, it's an ebook and it's it's going to be in Japanese and it's also going to be an audiobook and I suppose the whole nine yards.
As of right now, it got released in June. It is an ebook. It is, I think it just got released as an audiobook. The narrator, I think, is a man named Brian Ishii. I hope he does it justice with some of the expletives that I drop in there.
Well, don't drop those on our show. We're PG.
Oh,
baby.
No, I won't drop it on your show. But like you know, in the book, it's a candid look as the into the career, and sometimes it gets a little feisty and testy. And I've never claimed to be a politician, so sometimes it gets a little colorful.
Feisty and testy. That sounds like Jim and me on the show here sometimes. So that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk about the book shortly. I want to get to some other things. So. What experience, this is a question from Jim. He wanted to join us on the in the interview, but he's not able to because of time differences here. I am stateside. I'm doing this interview during my vacation period here. So Jim says, what experience or lesson or advice from the U.S. best prepared you for success in Japan?
That's a really good question. I could sit there and point to some things because I was lucky enough to talk to Aaron Guile, who longtime teammate and coworker now. I've now been working with Aaron for about 15 years. I could point to a few things that he said to me before I went over, but nothing really stuck until it actually came true in the real time, you know, halfway through the first year and then into the first year. And that really is just kind of along the lines of forgetting where you came from and just embracing where you're at now. We touched on it before this interview kicked off, was about being where your feet are.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is like just being able to open up your mind and not really thinking outside the box, because the Japanese game has been the Japanese game for a very long time. But some of the stuff that foreigners run into that are problematic is that American baseball players are people coming from the States to Japan kind of think that they're going to reinvent the wheel or bring in something new that hasn't been seen before. And that's just not the case. So it really, I think some of the best advice is just, you know, taking a deep breath, sitting back and observing as opposed to being super gung ho, mm-hmm. Right out the gate. It's important to, you know, obviously try your best and do everything you can to assimilate pretty quickly, but you know, you got to sit back and get a wide lens view of what's really going on. And if I talk to somebody that's going over there for the first time or a new foreigner on the team when we're in spring training, you know, I really encourage guys to, hey man, like sit back for a little bit and just watch how this is done and really take note, and because this is how it's going to be. And the quicker you can get on board with that, the more enjoyable your experience is going to be, because as a player, you're going to be able to fall in the routine and get to know your teammates a lot better, a lot quicker.
Okay. And he also asked, you know, the opposite or the reverse of that question. You came over here, you had some success. What lessons or advice from Japan helped you have success in the United States?
I think Japan really helped me, especially with Yakult and my situation. It really helped me to embrace my teammates and my coaches. When we're young, you know, I know my dad always kind of told me about, you know, you don't have to listen to everything everybody says all the time and use it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find teammates and coaches that do things and give you advice, and sometimes it's going to stick and sometimes it's not going to. And I think that helped me come back to the stateside because I had learned a brand new way of doing things. I reinvented myself in Japan. And coming to the States, there's a different ideology of how things are done, how practices are done, workouts are done, scheduling is done, approach to practice and approach to games is done. And it really was me staying true to who I was as an NPV pitcher, and while also being able to take that wide lens and see, okay, this is how it's done now. This is where we are now. This is how my teammates react and my coaches react. So my entire experience with Japan, the failures and successes, really helped me out when I came back to the States, of just being true to myself and sticking to my strengths and being who I am as a person and not trying to change for anybody else.
Gotcha. All right. Now, we had a recent question from a listener about the Swallows and their struggles. And quite frankly, I just see a bipolar team that in the past decade or so is either a league championship team or finishes last. So what leads to those kinds of results that are the opposite, these extreme results?
I mean, ultimately, it's performance on the field, getting everything together. When those championship years, there really was, you see it, you know, you guys watched enough to notice that during those championship years, those really good years, that everything's clicking, offense and defense together, you know, pitching and hitting, and everyone kind of seems to be healthy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the big things that, yeah, Colt, for all intents and purposes, for as long as I can remember, depth has always been kind of an issue. Outside of the key players, if all the key players are healthy and firing, it allows some of the support players to step up in situations that normally they wouldn't be able to, but they feel comfortable enough to take a risk. And when a key player is slumping or gets injured, now you're putting big time pressure on guys who, you know, I don't say aren't built for that moment, but they're not really ready for it, I guess is a way to say it, in their careers,
sure,
in their development.
Yeah, the lights are a little bright.
Right, you know, so I think, you know, I just think a lot of the times for Colt as an organization, depth is a key issue. And if when everyone's, the talent is there, you know, the talent, the veteran leadership, the abilities is there. It's just getting the entire team to fire on all cylinders at once. And that kind of seems to me to be the issue in some of those failing seasons when they're finishing down towards the bottom of the Central League. So depth is a key thing. And it really is, like you said, when it comes to bipolar team, it's just when they're hitting, they're not pitching. And when they're pitching, they're not hitting. And baseball's hard, and that's really hard to do consistently. So when we, as an organization, did have those championship years, it really was – The key of that was everybody's healthy and everybody's, you know, thumping and striking guys out and winning ball games consistently, whereas that just kind of seems to be not happening in the last year or two.
Yeah, we've seen it. All right, well, let's move on to your book here. Now, both Jim and I are writers. I'm not sure if you knew that because you went out and worked with someone else on a book about Japanese baseball when you had us right at your fingertips, but I'm not bitter. We still love you. But
let me defend myself, as this was not my project to begin with.
It wasn't, okay.
This was all Aaron. I'll give you a little backstory before you ask some questions about it. Aaron and I, we met in 2008 when I was in AA Mobile, Alabama, and he, as a college project, had reached out to me and asked to do an interview. I obliged, and we talked, and I did an interview there. I did a couple interviews for him along the way in the next year and a half, and then I ended up going to Japan. And he, even when I went to Japan, he asked me to blog for him a little bit, and I did that. So our relationship started back in 2008, and then as I kept playing and he just kept writing, and he kept asking questions, and he kept doing articles, and then he moved on in his journalism career, but we still kept in touch, and he would write an article every once in a while. And I went along my, you know, career in Japan, and he did interviews, and then I was in Texas, and he, obviously my story continued, and he kept going along with the storyline and acquiring information, acquiring data, and asking questions. And then eventually he was like, you know, I think I have enough material. I've talked to enough people. I think I'm going to write a book about this. And I kind of called him crazy. I was like, you're crazy. I was like, that's not going to work. You know, but he was bullheaded on it. And he just said, you know what? I'm going to write this book. I want to write this book, Tony. I think your story is fantastic. And I have all this information. So he just, from then, he started interviewing more people, asking me who I could, who he could interview to get more information. So him and I started working together to put him in touch with people that knew me about knew my career. And eventually, you know, I'm sitting there staring at a almost 400 page book about me and my trip from minor league baseball all the way to the big leagues into retirement.
Well, that's awesome. I think I'm hoping that some of the fans here of our show will get a copy, and whether it's an e-copy or an audible copy, and get to it. I sure am waiting for my signed copy to be shipped to my house, Tony.
Well,
please, I want to frame that as a question.
Country, so when you have a set address, I got one coming to you. How's that sound?
That sounds fantastic. Okay, so you answered all of my other questions basically with your defense. We were just jibing. It was just laughable, happy ribbing jabs at you. Nothing serious, but what we want to know, having followed you through your career here in Japan, how much sniping at Japanese baseball is in the book?
You know, not much, because, you know, I had a fond love for Japanese baseball. I really fell in love with it over there. Obviously, Yakult is near and dear to me. They gave me an opportunity when others didn't. And even after my first year, they gave me a second opportunity, which rarely ever happens in the NPB. You know, so there's really not much sniping, because I absolutely love Japanese baseball. I love the NPB. I'm fortunate now to still continue to work with Yakult, and I'm still in touch with Japanese baseball, and I speak very highly of it. And the book is really about, you know, just what I went through as a baseball player from minor leagues all through Japan, those six seasons where ups and downs, injuries, successes, the teammates I had, and then my trip through the major leagues, and it kind of just highlights the rarity of what I did as a player. Mm-hmm. We see guys a lot more now coming, you know, back and forth, that highway's open a little bit more. But for a guy like myself who had no major league time to begin with, to come back to the States and have some success, it's a rarity. Not many have done it in that manner. Mm. You know, we have Colby Lewis, Ryan Vogelsong, you know, like these guys that have had major league time, even nowadays, like Nick Martinez and Miles Mikolas and Michaelis, yeah. You know, and guys like that who had major league time, they had their cups of coffee, they had a brief experience of what it was like. Then they go to Japan and they develop more and find something new about themselves, take it back to the States for more success. Whereas I had never touched foot on a major league, you know, in a major league game before I sold out and, you know, went to Japan to find, you know, more growth and more development. So I had basically given up on the States when I went to Japan. It was like, again, like, be where your feet are. And for me to come back and have some success and have a, you know, short career, about 3.5-4 years in the States afterwards, it's a rarity for a guy like me. And for anybody who goes over there before touching foot on a major league mound and or a field, and for that matter, so it really does just touch on that. Touches on a little bit on personal life, what I went through with my family during that time, and what we experienced. And it also talks to other people like Aaron. Aaron Guile is throughout the book a lot, talking about Japanese baseball. You know, Aaron Fishman, the author, he interviewed some fans that he got a hold of. He actually took a trip to Japan and, you know, kind of immersed himself there for a little bit to kind of get a firsthand view of what Japanese baseball is like from a fan's perspective. And he, you know, didn't, so it really
he
isn't.
He didn't talk to us either.
I think I know he pulled from interviews that you guys had done with me.
Oh.
I believe so. Okay. Yeah, so I know Jim is, I've seen Jim's name in the book. I'd have to go back through there to see exactly what was said, when it was said. But, you know, it truly is just a kind of a cool story of a guy, me, who just never really gave up on himself and kept betting on himself throughout the whole way, you know, not letting any shortcomings or injuries or downtimes to get me too down. I always just kept pushing and persevering and trying new things and really embracing where I was at in order to fully develop and throw the ball really well there for a few years.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to reading or hearing it. If I get the audible version of it, I would love to do that and listen to your narrator speak as I work out. But in any event, we appreciate you coming on the show. Wish you the best with the book. Wish you the best with the Swallows and your current role. And please come on again.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's written by Aaron Fishman. The forward got my main guy Don Nomura to do the forward of the book. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I think it's a cool story. When I read back through there's a few pictures and stuff like that for those that are visually enticed, you know. So it really is a neat little story. I'm proud of it. It was terrifying to release, you know. because, you know, it's one of those things where you sit there and look at it, you'll go, do I deserve this? You know, there's so many guys that have done it better for me for longer, but at the end of the day, I do deserve it. I do, you know, deserve to have my story told, and I think it's a fun story, and I hope to inspire any young athlete along the way to just continue betting on yourself and keep going no matter what happens.
Sounds awesome, my friend. Good luck.
Thanks, John.
All right, so again, I'm really glad Tony contacted me and requested this interview. I think that's like the first time we've had anybody, former player or someone of note, request to be on the show. So that was cool. And you had, I believe, you tweeted something out about his book back when it was released. Yeah.
Sure, because Aaron Fishman interviewed me for the book, August maybe. And then he had sent me a review copy, and I retweeted his, you know, I retweeted and I've shared it on Facebook and so on. So not read it yet. Sorry, Aaron. Sorry, Tony.
It's so hard for, I mean, I'm going to get my copy in and I'm going to be saving it for the off season. It's so difficult to read a book during the season. Even if you start, you just snail through it.
I do audiobooks, except for the winter. I do audiobooks.
Yeah,
but I'm walking to and from the office.
But I loved Tony talking about the road to publishing, and it'd be nice to have Aaron Fishman on the show someday as well. But sure. What caught your ear?
Oh, a lot. First of all, feisty, testy, us,
me,
us, what?
Who?
Yeah, okay, yeah, I know what. Shocked. Okay. But I enjoyed the bit about reinventing the wheel. And, you know, he said, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And that is really, you know, that really struck home. Because I'll tell you why. Because when I came to Japan in 1984, and we're getting close to my 40th year. Japan anniversary.
Don't count.
Okay, won't count then. But let's say I'm close to being a 40-year-old Japanese person. Okay. In any case, all the same constant moaning about the way Japanese baseball is played, and I'm not immune from that disease. Particularly the shallow outfields ones, the endless, the predictable things that were really bad in the 1980s, worse than now.
Mm.
You know, all the number two hitters had to be under, you know, like 5'5", and they all had to be fast left-handed hitters who played second, short, or center field.
Mm-hmm.
And they really couldn't be good offensive players.
They weren't allowed
because it wasn't the role. You know, they had to know there was a kind of a caste system, and it was their job to know their place. You know, every player had a role, and they had to stick to it, and they weren't allowed to go outside it. And you could hear that in the language. But anyway, the whole thing was all the predictable bunting. It made people familiar with MLB and the growing wave of analytics that started about 6 or 7 years ago with the start of Bill James Baseball Abstracts, it made people think that if they got an American manager who managed American style, it would be an instant ticket to the pennant. And people thought that. I'm not kidding. It was 100%. You get an American manager, he'll win because he won't bunt. Well, let me tell you. But that's everybody. I would say that was, you know, I think, I don't know if Bob Whiting ever said that, but I was surprised. It was an arrogant and uncomplicated opinion as the one that said Japanese players will never be good enough to play in MLB before Hideo Nomo showed us how wrong we were. Now, well, I wasn't guilty of that one, but how they showed how wrong the common view was. But sure. So the whole thing about reinventing the wheel, yeah, that whole thing, that really struck home, that kind of hit, because I believe that, you know, I believed, you know, lineup construction could be improved, was a big deal, and it really isn't. And the sacrifice bunting was a big deal. It's a very tiny deal, because I found out the more I studied it, you know, how really small a deal it is, because you can sacrifice bunt and really good things can happen, and they don't have to happen very often for it to be a you know, almost make it a win, you know, a plus strategy. Anyway, moving along. So that whole thing, that whole idea, and him realizing he had to get rid of it and take a deep breath and observing, looking at things from a wide lens angle, was, I think, very astute. And then the other one was, and then of course the other answer, which was going back, because one of the problems so many import players have when they come to Japan is sticking to their core skills and finding a way to adapt their core skills to the Japanese puzzle without adjusting away and trying to be somebody they're not. You know, it's really hard, because very typically players fail when they come, or they eventually fail when they get, when people figure out ways to attack them with the skills that are prevalent in Japan, which they maybe haven't seen in America. So it's very easy to get thrown off of away from what works. And I thought the whole thing, what he said, staying true to what I was, when people were telling him it wasn't going to work, is really the core of every success story. You have to, and I don't mean just baseball, I mean in life, you have to tune your life to the way you are and accept you yourself for who you are. Faults and shortcomings and ugliness and beauty and joy and all that. You've got to be yourself. So I just loved that bit. And then of course, not trying to change for anybody else. That's the thing. So, and the last thing I would say was his comment about Aaron Fishman, about how stubborn and bullheaded he was. And I can certainly understand the work that takes, not from having done it, but when I have people frequently ask me, you know, when's your book coming out? And getting me to write a book is probably not as hard as it was to find the Titanic.
But close.
But Robert Ballard is out looking for that book now.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, I'm thinking about the statement you made here about Tony, and also in conjunction with Tony, with what Tony said was he reinvented himself. And to come over here to Japan, I mean, the book could be called Living the American Dream in Japan and Returning Home to the American Dream, because he didn't pitch in the majors before he left, and he went back to the States as a full-fledged major league pitcher with expectations and everything, which was great. It was fantastic. So
You can basically hear his enthusiasm and yet his humble pride about being the subject of a book like this in the interview. And that's what I wanted to talk about, was just the tone, because I'm genuinely thrilled for him. I mean, I'll try to read my copy in the off season. I'm going to try to get through it. I'm not really good at it. I would rather do audiobooks too, but I listen to so many podcasts that I think reading, I need to take some time to just read. And so I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, I really heard that he was excited that he was the subject of something like this. But then he was also humble in that, you know, little old me. And that he deserved it, but that he earned it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And the thing that I've discovered and sort of very late in life and is that the honest truth about yourself is pretty much, I think this is true for virtually all of us, is a really fascinating story. But that's a hard story to tell because, like I said, it comes warts and all.
Mm.
It's a hard one to say. It takes a lot of courage. And we have a Japanese acquaintance of Terrio's who wrote basically her memoirs of a very ordinary Japanese woman. But reading it, this woman and I have basically nothing in common.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of her, you know, her growing up in her situation, you know, rang bells about me and mine. Because it was true and it was human, and so it's remarkable how much every person has a good story.
Yeah, and then as far as what he said about the swallows being bipolar, I always say there's a fine line between winning and losing, and him saying, well, the replacements not being ready for the moment or just not able to come through, that's part of it, and that the injuries have taken a toll in those seasons in which they fell flat. And I agree with that. That is definitely, it just seemed to me that it's weird that it's feast or famine. And that's
it
one
is.
Of the teams. Yeah. And,
it
and
has been. Yeah. But he's
in
right.
Recent
that,
years.
I mean, he went through that. He went through that for years when, as I said, that the Swallows were probably making more money off of selling the ambulance concession to Jingu Stadium than they were on selling tickets for a few years.
And I remember joking that the injury bug had, you know, had a litter of bugs in it.
The infestation
infested the whole thing. And when they weren't there just biting, they were there feasting. Because there were seasons in which
the Swallows couldn't
make it through. So, yeah, but I totally understand.
The depth thing is absolutely an issue for them. And they just don't have, you know, the Giants will have the luxury, a few teams will have the luxury of, you know, if a pitcher can't throw strikes, you know, if you're the Hawks and you've got a pitcher who can't, he needs to work through his troubles. If he's with SoftBank, he's working out those troubles in the Western League.
Mm-hmm.
With the Swallows, he's working out those troubles with people trying to take him over the fence.
Right.
Because there's no point that the guys on the Eastern League, they don't have enough of them ready to throw strikes.
Or
so
quality strikes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, well, that is the thing.
That is the thing. Right. But really enjoyed Tony talking to us and talking to us about the book. And please go out and get your copy. And enjoy the book as well. We will make a four-seam transition here and go rocking with Roki.
Yeah.
Ugh is all I had to say about this game. And here's another one I missed, but I was glad to miss it. It ended up being a 4-3 loss at home to the Fighters on Thursday. I didn't see any of this game. I was in the air. I saw some highlights. What I could see just didn't look Roki-ish. It didn't look right. He's now 6-4 this season, but he is 3-2 in his most recent six games. That's 3-2 in decisions, and has lost two consecutive decisions, and hasn't won a game since August 1st. So things are not trending up.
He's only pitched twice, so.
Well, yes, and that's a problem too.
That is a problem too. Well, you know, I'll tell you what is the highlights of this game were worse than the game.
Well, he threw six innings somehow. He gave up four earned runs, six hits, five walks, struck out eight.
Yeah. So
it was ugly.
Yeah. Well, the game was, I've seen this before from him. He's almost a film negative of the typical Japanese start. I swear, how many times I'm watching a game and I'm writing, he didn't allow a hit through the first four innings. He didn't allow a hit through the first five innings. And then he gave up five runs in the fifth.
Mm.
You know, the guys get used to it and they get used to what's coming. And then they, you know, they leave an indelible mark on them. They tattoo them. And with Roki, it's a little different. He's had these games where he's been absolutely mediocre. He may be good in the first inning, and then he'll be mediocre for a couple innings, and he'll give up a bunch of runs. And then all of a sudden, it's like the light clicks, and things are working. And, you know, in this game, I think he was like 70 pitches. He was like 70 pitches after three innings. And then the last three innings, he was pretty much lights out.
So this is what I've
seen this a couple of times from him. You don't see that with a lot of, well, you do see it occasionally, but for him, it's kind of a trademark now. Anyway, I will say one thing about Roki Sasaki in general, and I haven't done the study, but I will say that I have just finished compiling my pitch database from 2020 to 2024.
Mm-hmm.
It's missing one game from 1 year and about 15 pitches from 2020. And I can tell you that in terms of the quality of the fastball, I can't say the raw quality of the fastball, for example, how it would play against MLB hitters, and the raw quality of the fastball, how it is by itself in a vacuum, because nobody throws in a vacuum.
Nobody, no.
Well, because they have their fastball is a component of the other pitches. It's affected by the other pitches they throw.
Sure.
But in terms of the effectiveness of his fastball has actually been as effective now as it has been. His splitter has been pretty much the big problem area. And the other thing is, people say, you know, oh, best fastball. He ain't never had the best fastball in Japan. He's had the fastest fastball.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. But it's not, and the best fastball from 20 to 24, there's like Shota Imanaga, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. There's probably a half dozen starters who had better, more effective fastballs than Roki Sasaki's. So anyway, that's just the way that works. But I just did want to get that out. On the other hand, if you're in MLB, you know, and you take away the context of pitching against Japanese hitters, you know, that changes a little bit. That changes the scale, because as one scout told me once, if you're one of these guys who can throw 95, but you mm-hmm. save it for the eighth inning, you might not get to the eighth inning.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I did want to mention that, but I'll have some more stuff on Roki Sasaki and other pitchers later coming on. But yeah, this game he played the B side first.
Yeah. Well,
it was a hit. It was a hit for the Fighters.
Yeah.
He's lost two. The Marines have lost two consecutive starts. Well, of course, the previous start was the one where he only had five. We don't know how bad it was going to be, because he got hit on the ankle against the fifth batter of the game.
He doesn't have his ERA is 2.45, which sounds good, but in the Central League there are a lot of guys with sub two ERAs, and the ERA and leader in the Pacific League has a sub two ERA, and he doesn't yet have enough innings to qualify for any official, you know, awards yet. So he hasn't hit the standard.
Nor has he ever.
I guess what's new is the name of that story. But this was the season he was supposed to be better. So we're gonna have to cut our Rocking with Rookie segment if he doesn't step up his game, because he's just not worth it if he's gonna be mediocre. I'm sorry.
He's lollygagging with Rookie.
No, it'd be like next segment, please.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about the races, make a two-seam transition. In the Central League, this is fantastic. This is, I mean, you know me, I want to see the last pitch in the last game decide all three playoff teams and their order, because I'm sick like that. But this is
Yeah, that
so
is, there's a cure for that, but it requires electroshock therapy.
There's no cure, buddy. You just think you could shock it out of me. You can't. But you could try. No, don't try. It sounds like it
I'm
hurts.
not, no, I'm not looking at this 2x4. I'm thinking it might work.
All right, well, good. Anyway,
No way.
the first place Hiroshima Carp have 59 wins. The second place Yomiuri Giants have 59 wins, and the third place Hanshin Tigers have 57, and you go down to fourth place, the Bay Stars have 54 wins. So everything is so tight. A three-game winning streak, a three-game skid can turn things around. The teams I think that really want to kick themselves are any teams that lose to the Dragons and the Swallows in this tight race, because those games you really need to put a lock on those games and win them. That's one thing. But I think DeNA is a viable playoff team, and it's pressing its face against the window, hoping to get into the playoff building. But that team has got to catch the ball better, plain and simple. The Bay Stars have trouble making plays with the gloves. And if they can do that, they might be. They've actually recently, it seems like they just can't score when they need to score. And when they did score 8 runs the other night, they let the Dragons of all teams come back and what, from 6 runs down or 7 runs down? I didn't see
I
the
think it was
game. I,
five.
all right, 5 runs down. It just
Yeah,
it seemed
lost
like a
nine
miracle.
to
So I'm adding on to the I'm exaggerating, I guess, because I couldn't believe it. After telling you, I think I told you the Dragons haven't come back from like a 1 or 2 run deficit all season, it seems like. And then twice while I was gone, they did it. So, and then, the Tigers are two. I think there are signs of life in Teruaki Sato's bat, but to me, I think it's the Carp. That team is the one that pitches enough. It catches the ball well. And by the way, Masaya Yano has been stellar as shortstop, maybe Gold Glove worthy. That team hits enough. And although there's not one player who's really, really consistent at the plate, who's,
offensively, yeah, the
yeah.
offensively they've got, I mean, the best guy is a guy who's basically does what he does every year, who is Takayoshi Noma.
Okay, yeah, I mean,
He's
they don't
just
have a standout
difficult.
offensive
Well, no,
player.
I mean, he's not a guy to ever win an MVP award. He's basically Central League regular material, you know. But the starting pitching has been routinely very good.
And the bullpen.
And the bullpen. And then all you have to do is have an eye shade ready for when Yoji Kuribayashi comes out, so you can just wait to hear if he saves it or not, because watching those saves sometimes is going to give people palpitations. He's
Yeah,
like
but
the pitcher of Living Dangerously.
hashtag high heat.
And it happened the other day too. I mean, he had a one run he had a one run lead against the Giants, and he gives up this line draw. What happens? But Shota Suikane is easily the worst. Why, he's the worst defensive outfielder they have, unless they put Matsuyama out there. And he makes a he chases the ball down in the corner, and he makes a leaping catch to save him having the leadoff runner on second with no outs.
Yikes.
And then after that, a next pitch hits a smoking liner to third. So basically, if it weren't for, that ball's a foot to one side, they're down, the game's tied. So that's Kuribayashi.
That's a problem. I think that and when they're playing in high pressure, high leverage situations in the playoffs, that could be a killer. But they probably are going to, if they win the pennant, they can play those games at home, and that's a lot different from having to go to Tokyo Dome and do that.
Sure.
So I had the Carp finishing second, so at this point, it's not far-fetched to see them winning the pennant. And I like the manager, so I'm really liking what I'm seeing from the Carp. And I think the other teams have to get their acts together. The Giants still, you know, they went out and got help. They've got Ilyaire. No talk to JBW Hernandez.
He's out for the season now.
Oh, yeah. What happened to him? I must have missed that while I was gone.
I think he has an ankle. Hold on. He has a left wrist. He has a wrist fracture that they're expecting to take for 4 months to heal.
Well, maybe he's got time to talk to us now since he's not busy.
But Coco Montez has been double trouble. This guy seems like he can't swing the bat that he doesn't get a double.
Yeah, doubles by accident. Like, I think his first hit was a bloop double.
Well, I didn't see that one, but every...
Or a bloop hit. Like, yeah, one or the
other. But I
thought
it was
a bloop double.
Doubles in his first three games. So, well, you know, today his base running was kind of... I think he hasn't had a lot of... It looks like he hasn't had a lot of experience running the bases, but...
Well, that's okay. They're only playing the Dragons, and you know they're only going to explode for a bunch of runs once in a while, so...
True enough.
You're good. You're good. All right. In the Pacific League, SoftBank is facing its annual summer drop-off or late season drop-off or something, or maybe it's early late season drop-off. I don't know what's going on. The magic number is announced, and then they start to stumble and bumble. So,
well, they had their magic number disappeared once.
Yes, because it's magic.
It is magic. It's
just like the car said, uh-oh, it's magic.
Very good. Very good.
I had to get a song that I predicted you would know just because it was played on the radio endlessly all the time in the 80s. Oh. Anyway, they just seem to stumble. But I'm looking at the Marines and the Fighters. And I'm looking at that battle for ostensibly second place and home field advantage in the PLCS in the first round. And I see the Eagles fading despite this gallant effort so far this season. So it's the Fighters and Marines who can get there to play at home and which team has the better arms to actually do something in the playoffs in advance. I would have to give the edge to the Marines, and I don't really care where you're playing. If Sasaki can get his act together and Kazuya Ojima and even Atsuki Panichi. If he can get his act together.
Yeah, if he goes back to where he was in 2022 and striking everybody out. Sure.
Yeah, we did see some other guys perform well for them. CC Mercedes has pitched well. So I see that team being able to win anywhere. So I think this is going to be really exciting. And I think the Fighters, what I'm seeing from the Fighters is that Tsuyoshi Shinjo, the manager, is looking to weigh his options in terms of starting pitchers. Who can he trust in a playoff situation, and how is he going to deploy those pitchers and try to go after, you know, the opponent, which he probably figures that everybody's figuring right now it's going to be the Marines. So
I think that's likely. Oryx is fading faster than that piece of newspaper I left out on the porch
during the rainstorm tonight.
Oh, man. It's all you can see is white. I can see his blank.
Nothingness, vast nothingness.
I interject here?
Sure.
I like it. I think it's the other way around. I think I like the Fighters better. I just, their offense has just got so much more pop. I mean, the Marines have essentially a three-player offense, although Katsuya Kakunaka is especially if you're throwing a right-hander.
Mm-hmm.
Is having a sort of a Dorian Gray season. He's playing like he's 29 years old instead of 36.
Okay, but I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah, go ahead.
But okay, then it's Neftali Soto, and he's okay, and he's got some home run pop, and Gregory Polanco has been quite reliable, and then it's Akito Takabe. And that's pretty much it. And
it's the Pips.
It is the Pips. It's Gregory Polanco on the Pips.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree, but I think the notion that the Fighters are just going to score runs because they have more I guess a more balanced lineup, or they
yeah,
have
they've
a
got
deeper lineup. I don't think it's going to always lead to runs, and that's the thing in the playoffs. You got to score runs, so you might get more hits, but that won't always win you a game.
Well,
so I think looking at it that way, with you talk about Soto and Polanco, their hits can be of more value because they can get a guy home from first base with one hit.
But I also think right now, Framil Reyes is the guy, and Martinez has proved he's the guy. So that's, you know, I think they've matched him, and Kotar Kiyomiya is really turning into he's taken a step forward from where he was a year ago.
He has.
And of course we can't say that about Chusei Manami. He's except for the cutting down the strikeouts, which is a positive sign.
And he really improved July, August, more steady, more.
Yeah. I mean,
consistent.
His approach is definitely, and as I've commented before, this is not, you know, making adjustments to, you know, making big adjustments, like how you approach plate appearances and, you know, trying to be more disciplined. This is a really slow process. It's a lot of tiny, tiny habits.
Yep.
That you have to, train, and it's not a straight line. So.
Yeah.
You know, he'll get, I think he's getting there, but I don't think he's quite yet. But I still like in general the package of I think a much deeper lineup. The pitching is more, I mean, we've seen the ups, we what I think what you're saying is we've seen the upside from the Marines pitchers. We've seen what Ojima can do, we've seen what Taniichi can do, we've seen, of course, what Roki Sasaki can do. Dallas Keuchel looks like a plus addition, but we've only had two starts, and as you know, in Japan, there's only five teams you're playing against.
Yeah.
So they're gonna be watching the video.
We'll see you next time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're gonna be seeing him in their sleep for a while.
Yeah.
Until they solve him.
Yeah.
So it's gonna be interesting, but the fighters pitching improved so much last year. And I think they've improved another step this year. And I would talk about, I think I mentioned it last week when I did my cold strike.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that the fighters are really good at getting cold strikes. It's a team thing. And that's helping them. That's helping them. So.
All right. Well, I mean, yeah, it's going to be fun. I just think the Marines can pitch with anybody, and they can pitch with them
they
on the
can.
Road, and I think that's going to be
they can. They just haven't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, they haven't consistently, but they
no.
can. Yeah.
No. Yeah. The ceiling, as I said, I think that is the ceiling. But okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And one note: Jim did his homework on home runs.
Yeah. Well.
Take us home.
Okay, indeed, I will. Very quickly, as I reported in May and in April and May and June, home runs were down about over 40% this year from the previous 3 years through the pretty much the first 3 months of the season. And having talked to NPB team people, reported that the best hit balls from a year ago were, you know, the same with the same launch characteristics.
Okay.
The launch same trajectory and velocity. Were traveling about 3 meters less.
Okay.
So let's say, you know, instead of a ball traveling 110 meters, it's going to travel 101 meters. And okay, let's say it's going to just get over the fence. Well, it might be traveling 6 meters less. So it's going to land short of the warning track is what he was telling me. And he said that was because the balls were literally coming apart at the seams because the yarn they were using was substandard, apparently. Well, I had the same day I had that conversation, somebody relayed a story about them switching out the balls, but that takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to A, stop producing the rest of the balls they intended to use this year and start producing the balls they intended to use for next year. So that's a process. And I don't think it started right at the beginning of August, but I think somewhere around the middle of August, we started seeing more and more of the balls that were intended for 2025. And the home run rates after being steadily 45% or 50% below what they had been the previous 4 years are now in the area of about 10%. And some of that, although it might be a little higher than that. And all I'm guessing is, yeah, we might be about normal. We might be about normal now. I don't know. Or it might also be possible that they had planned to make the ball because the balls have been steadily and steadily deader the last 4 years. It's been pretty much a straight line. And it seems like they're testing out the theory about throwing a frog in a pot of water and boiling it. It won't notice until it's dead. I think the plan was we won't notice the decline in home runs because it'll be so gradual.
Mm-hmm.
But then somebody tried to make more money on the yarn, more profit off of selling yarn to the baseball makers. And so it became fairly obvious. But it could be that the case that the plan for the 2024 balls was to be slightly deader than it was the year before.
Okay.
And they just got, I don't think what happened was part of the plan. But anyway, a colleague of ours said, really, you think NPB's smart enough to figure out that if, you know, something that complicated about gradually deadening the baseballs? Really, NPB? Are you kidding me? So I don't know. I don't take the big conspiracy theory. It's not like they do in MLB, which is keep balls that fly and make sure that if they know balls fly, make sure they're in games where big home run hitters are playing.
Mm-hmm.
So that they just get over the fence, or they, you know, hit two in one game. So to, you know, keep the ratings up and to keep the clicks up.
Right.
NPB, as our colleague said, if you think they're that smart, then have you actually been watching Japanese baseball for the last 30 years? Which is, that was fair enough. I was in a bit of a conspiracy theory rabbit hole there.
Yeah, you don't have any particular numbers, is what you're saying, though. That home runs are up.
Oh, I do know. I do know that they are down the last 3 years.
No, I mean, you said the ball had changed over the last month or so?
As I said before, the last time I checked, which was the end of June, home runs were down consistently month to month. We're talking about the same month.
Comparatively,
from 2021 to 2023.
Okay.
So April and March and April this year's were down like 40%. May they were down like 50%. June, they were down like 38%, like that.
Okay.
I don't know the exact numbers with
you
me
don't
now,
have the
but,
exact
but they've, but across NPB, they're now down 10% for July, for August.
Okay. All right, only down.
And I think it didn't start early in the month. I think it started maybe a couple of weeks ago that I started seeing balls flying like crazy.
Like crazy.
I mean, like normal.
Like normal. Well, that's crazy. Normal is crazy. All right, you heard it.
Yeah. Well, we're Americans. I think we're getting used to, we've been, crazy has become normalized.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. You're listening.
I am listening to you. I always listen to you.
You sound like a Stepford husband. All right, let's go to fielding questions.
You're always right.
All right, our newest friend, Tony in Busan in South Korea, sent an email. And he said, hey, John, and I'm going to throw Jim's name in there too, since he does a lot of the question answering. I heard your recent podcast. Sorry about the technical difficulties. Hope to hear my Kondo question response soon. So now you know this is dated. I had another question. He says, have you and Jim offered thoughts on the Sawamura Award this season? Do either of you have votes for the award, similar to how U.S.-based writers have votes for the various MLB awards? And then Tony gave us his top five, but let's hang on a second and hold off on that and Jim, you want to explain these things to him? Because he said any historical reason why this award is not across both leagues, not a Central League / Pacific League award like the MVP. And finally, anything interesting to know about how the award winners are picked? For instance, are pitcher wins still really important? Do closers do well? Thanks, Tony. All right, Jim, go for it.
One, we don't get a vote.
You know why?
Yeah, because...
No. That wasn't a real question.
I'm sorry.
The reason is because Jim and I have not yet received our classic curmudgeon club cards.
Ah, yes, indeed. and neither of us are former award-winning Japanese professional baseball starting pitchers.
Well, that's beside the point. You have to have graduated from curmudgeon school to get into that.
Curmudgeon Academy is the official name, I'll have you know. And we lost our, I lost my favorite curmudgeon last year. And another guy who actually wasn't really a curmudgeon, and we lost him, and that was Manabu Kita Beppu, who was a longtime member of the panel. But we did lose Choji Murata, and he wasn't on the panel last year, and this is really sad, but we'll save that story for another day. But Murata was great because he was one of those guys who had off-the-wall opinions, mm-hmm. and he didn't care who knew about it. If he thought it, he's going to say it.
There you go. Have
and
some.
It was, and my editor used to say, let me guess, you did the Sawamura story. What did Choji Murata say that you have to write about?
I love it.
So it was, yeah, 2 or 3 years in a row. He's like going, okay, what did you say today? Okay, so we miss you. Miss both those guys. I never had a chance to speak to Kita Beppu. But anyway, yeah, so they had to be these former pitchers. And in a nutshell, the Sawamura Award was created before the two leagues were created. And it was some publisher who did it. It's not the current sponsor. But at the time, the Central and Pacific, the Japanese baseball expanded and split into two leagues ahead of the 1950 season or shortly after, Yomiuri became the sponsor of the award,
mm-hmm.
and it became a Central League award because the Giants, the Eiji Sawamura was a Giants pitcher, and it became a Central League award until the year before Hideo Nomo won it in 1989, I'm going to venture. So it did not become no Pacific League pitcher won it until Hideo Nomo, because no pitcher was eligible until the year before. Now, the award is decided by a panel of five former pitchers. I think the Central League guys are all former winners. Some of the Pacific League guys are not because they don't let anybody who pitched recently enough in the Pacific League to have won it. Because they're not old enough.
Yeah.
And they're not crusty enough. I think.
They haven't graduated from the Curmudgeon Academy.
That's right. They're still on the waiting
still
list.
Still working on their masters. Yeah.
Indeed. So anyway, so there's no 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 vote, although that's an interesting question. And anyway, so there's that. And it is an award only for starting pitchers. And technically, the award is for the pitcher who most emulates the style of flame-throwing young Giants pitcher Eiji Sawamura, the guy who famously struck out 4 MLB Hall of Famers in a off-season tour of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It was Babe Ruth, Charlie Gehringer, and Lou Gehrig were 3. I forget who the 4th was.
Okay. And yeah, how many benchmarks were there? 7 or 8 benchmarks?
I think there's 8 now. 7 had been 7 for many years. And the benchmarks had gradually declined because pitchers stopped
doing completing, complete games.
Yeah, it's now 10 complete games, but it used to be like 15. And it used to be like 250 innings instead of 200 innings. And it used to be more strikeout. You know, everything, I think the strikeouts has not changed so much. I think the innings pitched has decreased, and the complete games have dramatically decreased.
And just the lowering of the bar in general, because the game has changed. It's not necessarily because the pitchers are weaker or anything.
No, that's true. And the newest stat is the newest benchmark is, I guess, what's the word? Extreme quality starts. There's a quality start plus,
right?
Kind
extreme,
of thing.
Yeah,
which is, I think it's 7 innings, allowing 2 earned runs or less or something to that effect. Anyway, so they consider that as well, but it's not a hardened. But the benchmarks are not always followed. Couple of times, I know twice that the pitcher who won, pitchers have won the Sawyer Merle Award with a whole bunch, like a really lopsided totals in one areas, when another pitcher just barely cleared all the benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
So Yu Darvish missed out one year when Hisashi Iwakuma was the winner. And there was another case, I think, when Chihiro Kaneko won, there was another pitcher who satisfied all the benchmarks.
All right. So here's Tony's list. He's got 1, Levon Moinello of the Hawks. 2, Hiroto Saiki of the Tigers. 3, Daichi Osara of the Carp. 4, Kohei Arihara of SoftBank, and 5, Tatsuya Imai of the Lions. And he says, I'm a sucker for the strikeouts. And so I want to give my, I think we did mention this earlier in the season, but we just touched on it briefly. And I think I mentioned guys like Tomoyuki Sugano saying that he was having a good year. He's having a really good, quiet bounce back year. But since then, I think, we've had some guys move up. And I would like to say this, that it's about the numbers at the end. So we're far from that. I think the guys have 4 to 6 more starts. Some guys do, probably with the rainouts and the makeup games, they can sneak a couple guys in there for some extra turns.
Yeah, but 6 is about as much as they're going to get.
But maybe at the most 6, right. And so I think there are a couple guys who can move up on the list. I think, I think Levon Moinello, probably with the wins, he might be the guy who leads in that category, but I don't think he gets the Sawamura Award. And it's not just because he's not Japanese. I think Chunichi's Hiroto Takahashi, with the wins and the strikeouts and the ERA, he still has a sub-ERA now. He still hasn't met the requirement for innings pitched to be in the among the leaders, but he's right there.
Mm.
And he's got double digits in wins already for a horrible, horrible team. He has 40% of their wins, just about. I think they have 48 wins. He has 10, so close to 50.
And they've won a bunch of his starts that he didn't finish.
He wasn't involved
in the decision. So,
well, I wouldn't say a bunch, because I don't think he got a couple late starts.
A few,
yeah. Then I have on the list Osara as well, and then Tomoyuki Sugano, whom I mentioned just earlier, just a second ago, because of his the quality starts, the wins, and the steadiness that he has given that rotation. And then DeNA's Katsuki Azuma, he has 20 quality starts. That leads Japan.
Out of 20, yeah.
And he has a bunch of wins as well, so I think he should be on the list. And then Rakuten's Takahisa Hayakawa, I think he's probably, for me, he's better than Imai. He has more innings pitched, a better ERA, more complete games barely. And he only has 10 fewer strikeouts. And so I would put him on the list before I put Imai on there. Although Imai has done well, he just hasn't been. And I think
again, part of
the thing with the Lions is being depressed.
Yeah. Pitching for the Lions is not always, it's not any job that people actually sign up for.
Dragons,
unless they're out of work.
Dragons too. Yeah, unless they're out of work and they're paying real money. What do you have, Jim?
I've got my number one guy right now is Hiroto Saiki.
Mm.
Because the complete games helps him out, the ERA helps him out, that helps him out more than those two help him out more than Takahashi.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like the stuff and the overall makeup as much, but you know, he is pitching for a team that'll score some runs behind him, So that should jack up those. You know, he could get a really impressive win total.
Total, yes.
And then I have Hiroto Takahashi and Katsuki Azuma.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have Levon Moinello and I have Hayakawa. And I have Levon Moinello ahead of Hayakawa because one's got a 1.6 ERA and the other's got a 2.2 ERA.
Right.
So, yeah, but those five guys could all win. Sugano could too. I don't really think because of the losses, I don't think Shosei Togo is a candidate now like he was in May. He's 9-6 now, so he'd have to finish, you know, he'd really have to finish 15-6 or something.
If he could rip off a few in a row.
Yeah, and throws a couple of shutouts, sure. I mean, his ERA is fine. It's not terrible. But if he has some complete, he's already got a bunch of complete games. Because they let him go until he gets, you know, somebody hits him.
Let that young arm go. Go, son, go. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically his name. I think certainly Imai probably should be up there among the candidates, and we'll see where he is when the season ends. Again, I said guys are going to have more starts and more opportunities. And I believe Imai threw today. I'm not sure if he got the win or not because I didn't see the end, but I'm assuming he got the win because I think
I believe he did, and I think they were not playing the Buffaloes again. They're playing the Eagles today.
They're playing the Eagles, so yeah.
And they did win.
And they did win, so that'll give them another W, so that's good. But,
four wins in five games. I mean, it's raised the flag, baby.
Yeah, and I do want to give Junichi's Rydell Martinez a shout-out. Even though he can't win the award, he's saved like 71% of Chunichi's wins, 34 of 48 as of Saturday.
Well, that's not, you know, people say, you know, it does help that your team actually does have a lead in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
But pitching for a good team and a bad team is relatively a very tiny thing, because if you pitch for a really good team, they have relatively fewer save opportunities in their wins. With Chunichi, if they're winning, you got a save opportunity.
Yeah, because they don't win by much.
Three runs probably a handful of times a year.
They don't win by much, yeah.
So,
all right, Tony, thank you so much for the question. And this was a fun exercise. Really enjoyed that. Anyone else who has a question, please hit us up on x.com with the hashtag HighHeat. Send questions by email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. And you can also go to the Facebook page and leave us a message there. Look for us on iTunes and other platforms. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
And see you at the ballpark.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBWPodcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag HighHeat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.